Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is the Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the news of last week and preview the week ahead. Joining me on the roundtable today from the Ohio Capital Journal, we have reporter Marty Schladen. Welcome back, Marty.
Good morning, Amy.
And Jake Zuckerman, reporter for Signal Ohio. Welcome back, Jake.
Thank you for having me on.
And Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hannah News Service. Welcome back, Shane.
Good morning.
So we are going to talk about SNAP, but first we have a map, and I enjoy a rhyme, so I'll go with it. The Ohio Redistricting Commission last week voted 7-0, with Republicans and Democrats approving a new congressional map. And I wanted to play some reaction to the map from redistricting activists who showed up at the statehouse last week to testify to denounce the whole process. So you're going to hear three voices speak, and this is a sound clip from Ohio Public Radio's Statehouse News Bureau.
This was just performative.
I thought that there would be more of an opportunity to not just jam through a map at night.
The map is crap, that's all.
There. So I enjoy the map and SNAP rhyme. He said map is crap, you know, there you go. So that last comment, though, came from a Republican. Shane, the changes to these maps favor Republicans. Three districts were the most hotly contested. Can you explain to me what happened here, the old map versus the new map, what changes there are?
There are changes all over the place, but most of the changes came in the first congressional district, which is down in Cincinnati. That's Greg Landsman's current district. Then you had some changes to Marcy Kaptur's ninth district, which is Toledo. And then they made a little bit of line adjustments also in the 13th district, which is currently held by Amelia Sykes. The 9th district with Marcy Kaptur became more Republican. They pushed the lines more into northwestern Ohio. It kind of goes a little bit along the lake. You don't quite have the snake on the lake that you had from 2010 to 2020, but it definitely becomes more Republican, and it's going to be a much harder for her to win. Greg Landsman's district, the first district now, they pushed it more into the western parts of Hamilton County. And in addition to the Republican Warren County, they also picked up Clinton County as well. So that is now more considered a toss-up district that leans Republicans. Democrats, though, seem to think that Landsman has a chance. I guess Joe Biden won the district in 2020. Trump won it in 2024. I think Sherrod also won it, and maybe in 2024 as well.
Okay, so describing maps on the radio is hard, but yes, we're doing a good job here. So, but basically, explain to me, Shane, why the Democrats voted for this map.
It's kind of your gun to the head scenario. They sat down with the leadership of the Democrats, Leader Isaacson in the House, Leader Antonio in the Senate, and they showed them a map that was a 13-2 Republican map. And they said, if you don't deal with us, this is going to be the map that we are going to pass through the General Assembly once this leads to the Redistricting Commission. So to the Democrats, they felt that this was their best opportunity to protect the five incumbents, the Democratic incumbents that they had. Leader Isaacson told reporters afterwards, he said, you know, technically the map that they passed in 2021 favored Republicans in the first district, the 13th district, and the 9th district. And so he said, you know, it was a 13-2 map then. It still is a 13-2 map now, but we have an opportunity to win this versus what they would have passed had we not have dealt.
Jake, what do you make of the fact that we got this map on Friday? I thought we were going to be waiting all the way till the end of November, like the 11th hour.
I'm still processing this. I'm someone who doesn't cover this stuff day to day, but obviously all issues to flow downhill from redistricting. So, I mean, some things that stick out to me, you know, on the one hand, like right now Democrats see a world where they can keep the status quo of a 10-5 congressional split. And there's a set of circumstances where it still could be a 13-2 seat, or maybe 11-4 would be a little more likely. So that, in my mind, kind of reflects Ohio growing probably slightly more conservative in the past few years, but nothing egregious. The flip side of that argument is, you know, Cincinnati is an area that is really getting more liberal, getting more Democratic. But on these maps, the district has gotten more conservative. So there's a clear discord there. But all in all, this system, if you, you know, just read the amendment and think it through, it's designed to try to force two people, you know, two opposing parties into a room and say, come up with a compromise. Everyone should leave unhappy. And that's kind of what happened. So maybe depending on your interpretation of events, the system worked as it was designed. Maybe it didn't. You know, there's still like there's still some obvious problems of gerrymandering here. The language has been very explicit from all parties of like what political outcome we're desiring when we're drawing these lines. So it is a gerrymander, almost as a matter of fact, by the language that's being used here. But maybe the system worked.
And then that's going to be the argument the Republicans made. And that's going to be one of the reasons why they dealt, too, is they can now say the system works. So when and likely another amendment comes, they can say, well, look, we had a map. It was passed 7-0. It was unanimous. It was a bipartisan map. This system worked.
Here is Senate Minority Leader Nikki Antonio, who called it the best way forward.
We still have a broken system, though. It's a hand of cards that we've been dealt.
And here's Republican co-chair Brian Stewart defending the process.
Has resulted in a bipartisan compromise. And I think most people who are not paid activists are going to be pleased with the result.
So what's the rationale for having...
I am not a paid activist.
All right. So Marty, in the background there, someone who was listening to this press conference said, for the record, I'm not a paid activist, meaning that I don't know if that person considered themselves an average person who just cared. It sounds like a lot of people are not happy. What do you make of this whole process?
Well, I think that the Democrats, as the other two have said, are stuck between a rock and a hard place. The current districts were ruled by a previous Supreme Court to be gerrymandered in favor of the Republicans. And this gives the Republicans still more power. And I could see people who have, you know, volunteered on this issue being frustrated because, you know, they want to see their side fighting and not give the Republicans the ability to say, well, this is a bipartisan decision. But that said, you know, there's still this consideration, you know, do you really want to give Donald Trump everything he wants? Not for nothing. You know, Donald Trump and Jack Posobiec, they're not happy. Jack Posobiec being a Republican provocateur, they're not happy with what Ohio Republicans did in this instance.
Because they felt they could have gone even further. They could have 14-1, you know, take as many as you can.
Yeah.
And Shane, just to end on with the redistricting, there was some talk of Democrats taking the issue back to the ballot. But as you said, on the other side, they can say, well, it passed 7-0, right? So is that probably not going to happen?
No, the more likely scenario is you'll see a court challenge. Mm-hmm. But that will have to go to the Ohio Supreme Court. And a lot of the people who voted to strike down the previous map are no longer on the Ohio Supreme Court. So it might be more of a friendly Supreme Court to Republicans. Also, the aspect of doing a ballot initiative, which would have been a referendum, it would have cost a lot of money. You would have had to try and convince people to vote against it. And as Leader Antonio said, okay, the people strike this map down, we just go back to the same place we were at the beginning of this process all over again. And who's to say we're not going to have a different result?
Maybe the Democrats were better off putting their money into trying to help Captor and Landsman win, right? Or something. I don't know.
I would assume that would be a consideration. Another thing with this map, too, is it does make Amelia Sykes's district a little more safe. And one of the questions I asked the Leader Antonio was, okay, it seemed like a lot of the discussion was around Landsman's district and Sykes's district. Mm-hmm. Why did Landsman's get redder? Why did Sykes's get bluer? Well, Leader Isaacson kind of rejected the fact that, you know, it's not a seat that Landsman can't win. I thought Antonio made an interesting point, which is with the Supreme Court considering the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the last part of it, the minority representation part of it, this maybe preserves another black member of Congress.
Interesting. Okay. Well, and then the last thing I'll ask you is that clip that I played from Brian Stewart where someone was in the background yelling, "For the record, I'm not a paid activist." What was that all about? Do you know? Oh, or Marty, do you know?
Go for it.
Yeah.
Well, just that's something you hear at the protests too. For example, I was in Newark on October 18th and a couple of guys were driving around the town square with Trump flags flying out of the back of their pickup truck, and a guy had a bullhorn and he was trolling the crowd, and he kept telling them that they were bussed in and paid to be there, over 1,000 people. But I think that this is just this online conspiracy theory that people on the other side, their motives are impure, they're being paid to, you know, these aren't real opinions, they're just being paid for them.
It's a political talking point.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And we are talking today with Shane Stegmiller from Hanna News Service, Jake Zuckerman from Signal Ohio, and Marty Schladen from the Ohio Capital Journal. Well, now that we're done with the map, let's turn to SNAP. The government shutdown continues and SNAP benefits are in a bit of limbo. They were set to run out this past Saturday for the first time in its 60-year history, but two federal judges intervened on Friday, ruling that President Trump was required to continue funding the program. I think there's a noon deadline today, but this ruling from these federal judges stems from a case that was brought by the city of Columbus and a coalition of other cities and nonprofits. Marty, can you tell us what's the latest? Will SNAP benefits be paid to Ohioans this week, I guess?
We don't know. What I've heard most recently is the Trump administration saying that some delay is likely. And, you know, how long that is not just an academic thing. If you're one of the 1.5 million Ohioans who depend on the program, because you don't have enough money for food and it's the beginning of the month, that's when, you know, the cupboard's typically bare. So I think we're all waiting to see how many days this extends and what happens.
And the Ohio Association of Food Banks executive director has been interviewed many times and told the Columbus Dispatch on Friday there will be a lapse in SNAP benefits and said to visit ohiofoodbanks.org and go to Find Your Food Bank for more help. But prior to the judge's ruling, Governor DeWine last week signed an executive order releasing $25 million in food aid. Here's the governor talking to the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau.
This is not a substitute for SNAP. Not every family is going to get additional funds, but we wanted to target specifically those families where we thought that they really desperately would need the money and would need the help.
All right, Jake. So $25 million is not going to fix it. That's not enough money for everyone. There were calls to use more money, use the rainy day fund that the state has to, you know, patch this hole. What do you make of the $25 million?
Yeah, I mean, some basic math is useful here. There are about 1.4 million Ohioans who claim SNAP. Someone step in if that sounds funky. And they get about an average of $200, give or take, allotment. So if you do the math, $25 million does not go very far at all. This really needs the federal government. And so, there has been this idea that has been kicked around by the Democrats, I think, in the Ohio House, of draining Ohio's rainy day fund or at least tapping into it to pay these bills. You know, that has – Ohio has to run a balanced budget, so we borrow money for some of – with permission of the voters, Ohio can borrow money. But rainy day funds are the sort of things that credit analysts really value. So we could make this short-term decision to tap into that fund. The expense might be some pretty steep long-term borrowing costs. So all that's pretty wonky to say there are no great answers. You know, when there has just been from the top down – by the way, in every federal government shutdown, SNAP benefits has always continued to flow. Mm-hmm. This is the first one where they've been cut off. There's just this sudden loss of money that goes to this very important place of food, you know, a very basic human need for a lot of people in the state. I think this just shows there aren't really great answers when that happens.
And Marty, what do you make of maybe would DeWine get his $25 million back once the government opens up again? Or is it a risk? Because they don't know if they'll get the money back, right?
I think the risk potentially extends beyond the $25 million. There's probably a fear that this is going to set a precedent send a signal to this administration that the states can support this program. You know, it's always been a federal responsibility, but there's a big push to slough these costs, you know, push them down the hill to the lower levels of government. You know, we've seen it here at the state level, but I think that, you know, the Trump administration would like nothing better than have the states pick up the cost of these sorts of programs.
Last week, WOSU's Matthew Rand talked with Michael Corey. He's the executive director of the Human Service Chamber of Franklin County, who advocates for nonprofits. And Corey called SNAP a brilliant, simple, effective program. And he spoke about the loss of this social safety net.
I think we are going to see just how creative and resilient not just our food pantry system, but our community is going to be in problem solving and helping people, because we're not going to be okay with people being hungry. In terms of what we want to see, we want government to reopen, and we want the social safety net to be funded, not defunded. And let's not forget, in July, this government cut SNAP and cut Medicaid. Those are pieces that are under unique duress already.
So the Medicaid piece there, I'm not sure who can talk about that, but there's been cuts to SNAP, but then Marty, also there's a Medicaid piece as well.
Yeah, it's the estimates vary, but it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 trillion over 10 years, and most of the work is going to be done through these new work requirements. They've been tried in states like Arkansas. They haven't been shown to increase employment, but they do push people off of the system. So that's $1 trillion, and it's not, I think, a little less than $200 billion over that same period being cut from SNAP. Meanwhile, huge tax cuts got extended to the richest Americans in that same bill.
All right. Well, we will see what happens with SNAP. There's a noon deadline today for the Trump administration to respond to those two federal judges' rulings from Friday. So something will happen. And then for people who are listening who want help with food assistance, we have OhioFoodBank.org, as I mentioned. And then Michael Corey also suggested a site called Fresh Track, T-R-A-K, Fresh Track. So coming up on the Reporter Roundtable, we are going to talk about property taxes, and lawmakers have passed an energy bill. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, we have Jake Zuckerman, reporter for Signal Ohio, Ohio Capital Journal reporter Marty Schladen, and Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hanna News Service. I wanted to do a quick update on property taxes. County boards of commissioners had until this past Friday to vote on a new property tax relief program for seniors and homeowners, but very few counties were signing on. It's called the Homestead and Owner Occupancy Piggyback. Jake, can you tell me a little bit about this, about why counties are not signing up for something that lawmakers did to help with property taxes?
Yeah, I can. And what I know about this, I know from Jordan Laird of the Columbus Dispatch. Thank you, Jordan Laird of the Columbus Dispatch. The gist of it is that the state gave counties this new, really just an instrument to give certain homeowners, I think military and seniors, if I remember, a discount on their property taxes, which is another way of saying less money to the local government. Mm-hmm. But there's no money coming from the state to replace that revenue, so no counties have been taking the state up on that offer.
Yeah.
So it's almost this predictable situation of no government is willfully saying we will take less money from you, the citizen.
Yeah, same. I learned about it from Jordan Laird as well. So she wrote that Franklin County, Delaware County, Licking County, none of those signed on. So this is just, I don't know. It's like if a law passes and no one uses it, is it a law, Shane?
No. And that's one of the interesting dichotomies of this whole property tax debate is there's been criticism that a lot of these solutions that the state's been coming up with, especially the General Assembly, they're not really putting any skin in the game. The state's not really kicking in money to help offset it. It's more like we're gonna pass down these reforms, which are good discussion points, but we're not gonna backfill any of the loss of revenue that a lot of these local schools and local governments are gonna have.
Yeah, Marty, I mean, even just this past week, the Columbus Library said they're not going to build a planned 24th branch because they don't feel like there's enough secure state funding. They don't know what's going to happen with property taxes, so they need to put a pause there and wait. I mean, do you think that a lot of places feel in property tax limbo?
Oh, sure. And, when you're talking about that sort of infrastructure, you've got to plan decades in advance. Mm-hmm. And as this has happened, they've had their own resources steadily eroded. So, yeah, it looks to me like, on the part of the legislature, this is just completely an empty gesture. It's a way of talking about doing something about property taxes. But as Shane said, they didn't put any skin in the game.
Mm. And there's an election tomorrow. And there are several school districts around the state that have levies on the ballot related to property taxes. There's some other kind of levies. There's bonds in Olentangy. There's an earned income tax in Westerville. But there are property tax levies out there. Do you get the feeling that the school districts are worried?
I think so. I mean, over the last 10 years, the amount of the levy failure rates, it used to be such a sure thing. If mm-hmm. you run a levy, it will pass. And I think that has become increasingly less true. And I think that the way that this – it's such a dominating news issue. I think there's a ton of awareness every couple of years when people's properties get reassessed. Everybody gets angry. I think it's just a much tougher political environment right now to get a levy across the board.
And Shane, there were a few property tax related things that passed, and then lawmakers are still working on more. Aren't there still more out there that are in flux?
There are a number of proposals, and I think that's one of the issues that they want to keep looking at. I think a lot of them are in the Senate now, too. So I expect to see some kind of movement on something before they break. They're trying to aim to be out around Thanksgiving. So
In the next 2 weeks.
Stay tuned. We'll see what happens in the next 2 weeks.
Okay. Well, moving on to clean energy. Jake, there is new legislation that would put the emphasis on natural gas and redefine the words clean energy. Can you tell us, how do we redefine what clean energy means?
Yeah, well, there's an important distinction here I like to make because we're talking legally, because you cannot just change the definition of commonly used words through the Ohio Revised Code, no matter how hard we try. So I just
define clean.
To set that anchor point. What I would say is anyone who uses the term clean energy, you could quibble about nuclear's place in the word, but generally we're talking about an energy source that does not pollute the air, that does not warm the planet. Natural gas does that.
So when I think clean energy, I think wind and solar.
Yes.
Is that okay?
Yes, and I think there are people who would say nuclear is clean energy, and there are people who would quibble with that. But okay. I think, primarily what we're talking about is are you destroying the planet? Are you altering, harming, maiming the planet in some way? Natural gas, we're talking about methane here. It has immutable properties. It will trap heat in the planet when it leaks, which it always leaks in the extraction and transportation. And when you burn it, it produces carbon dioxide, which is the central driver of global warming. So now that we've established that, yes, this law would say that natural gas is a clean energy source, and it directs the Power Siting Board, which is a group of gubernatorial appointees, to in different ways just sort of favor. It's a general policy statement, so its effects are a little bit hazy. But they're saying, look, what we want are sources of energy in Ohio that are affordable, clean, and reliable. And the bill defines those words, including clean, which we've talked about, and says, so, it's like a little bit of a maze to follow what the bill's trying to do. But when you parse out the definitions, it's saying to the Power Siting Board, we want more natural gas. So think about that when you're doing your power siting decisions.
So tomorrow morning at 10, we are doing a show about the state of energy in Ohio. It's based on a 3-part series that WOSU produced. And joining us will be the Republican chair of the House Energy Committee. So we'll learn a little bit more about that. Does anyone else want to weigh in on energy before I move on?
Well, I just want to say, you know, I think Jake makes an excellent point about, you know, methane being a greenhouse gas in and of itself and carbon dioxide. And when you get this sort of Orwellian language written into law, it makes one suspect that the energy lobby in Ohio just has a whole lot of power. You know, that's how these things happen. And that's been my experience since I've been in Ohio. Like, severance taxes are really low, and they kind of get whatever they want. Now we're building all these data centers where we're spending, you know, what, $1 million per job created, and they're all going to suck a lot of energy, and that's being used as an argument to, use more gas.
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is the Reporter Roundtable, and you're listening to Marty Schladen from the Ohio Capital Journal, Jake Zuckerman from Signal Ohio, and Shane Stegmiller from Hanna News Service. Kind of energy adjacent, Marty, the Ohio Supreme Court recently heard arguments in a case that asks whether big increases in certain utility charges are legal. The question is before the court, and it's whether the state's regulator, the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, also known as the PUCO, acted legally or not in 2023. Back then, it allowed Columbia Gas of Ohio to increase its fixed monthly charges from $36 a month to $58 by 2027. So that's a 50% increase. Were you following this case?
Yeah, I've been since 2023, actually. Mm-hmm. Well, the fixed monthly charge is a big deal, especially if you're like, you know, a single parent living in a fourplex in Whitehall and you're going to pay $58 a month before you burn your first molecule of gas. That's a lot of money, you know. But it's the mix, too, because what happened here is they scrapped the fuel efficiency program for non-low-income people. And that would have, you know, given you rebates to buy energy efficient appliances and stuff like that. You know, back to the power of the energy lobby, it leaves one to suspect that, you know, somebody's just trying to sell, you know, take away the incentive to save gas to sell more gas. So now it's gone from about 20% fixed charges to, by 2027 under the current arrangement, 70% of your gas charges will be in the form of fixed charges. And most customers will have no efficiency incentives. And that's what these environmental groups are saying. The PUCO acted wrongly in allowing that, especially because when they first went to fixed charges back in 2008, it was to help give the gas companies a bulwark against efficiency programs. You can collect this fixed charge money to protect against less gas sales. And now they flipped the thing on its head.
So the arguments were heard, right? And we're just waiting for a decision? Is that okay?
Yep.
All right. So, So I wanted to move on to one other topic here. There's an election tomorrow. I mentioned that earlier. So just a reminder, it's election day. Polls are open tomorrow from 6:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. There's no statewide issue, but there are local issues. Columbus has a race for city council and Columbus City School Board. There's other races around Central Ohio. And Columbus also has a nearly $2 billion bond issue on the ballot to allow bonds to be issued for affordable housing, parks, safe drinking water, and more. There are a lot of little things throughout the ballot. Everyone's ballot will look different. What is everyone following whenever it comes to tomorrow's election? Jake, is there anything you're going to be following?
Maybe I write from a statewide perspective, so less so. But as a Columbusite, I'm curious about this Jesse Vogel, Tiara Ross race.
That's the
city council race.
Yeah, so they're running for District 7, but the city council, everyone in the whole city votes for it, not just District 7. We did do a show last week with Jesse Vogel and Tiara Ross, so you can find that at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to hear from both of them. All right, so you're interested in the city council race. Shane, is there anything you're interested in for tomorrow?
So we'll kind of take a state. We also mainly look at the state, and we'll take a statewide overall perspective on how the levies do. We usually put in something about how all the school levies do and the library levies. I'm also a Westerville resident, so I'll be interesting to see how the Westerville tax issue does. That seems to be it's an income tax issue versus a property tax because that had failed previously. And it feels like there's definitely a lot more of a campaign going on, and there's definitely a lot of strong opinions on both sides.
Yeah, that Westerville issue is a big one. I interviewed the superintendent about it. She was pointed in reminding me that it is an earned income tax levy. Like, she made sure I wanted to say that, not just income tax, but earned income tax, meaning that you're, like, you know, if you're retired and you just get Social Security, you're not taxed on it. It's earned income. Anyway, so Westerville's levy, though, Shane, I feel is interesting because I feel like it's their property tax levy failed back in May. So they're trying earned income tax this time. And I feel like every school district in the entire state is watching Westerville to see if this works.
Yes, yes. And it's definitely a different approach. So
is there a strong no campaign? Do you see no signs?
I do see a lot of no signs. I don't know how organized of a no campaign, but it's a lot of the people who just already feel that there's just so much tax already, and especially if you're an older resident, your kids are not in the schools, you don't see what the schools are doing, you might be less inclined to want to vote for it.
Yeah.
And Westerville's been pretty good about, you know, supporting most of the levies that have come before
up until this last property tax levy.
Yeah, and that was actually last November that one failed.
Oh, okay. Do I have the wrong month?
Yeah, they were thinking about putting something on May, and then they decided to step back to see what the state legislature did in the budget, and then the state legislature didn't satisfy them, so...
Yes. Didn't satisfy them. That's a very diplomatic way of saying that. All right. And then, Marty, what are you watching for tomorrow's election?
Like Jake, I'm a Columbus resident, and I'm watching the city council election. And I just want to make the point that the notion that these people actually represent districts when all the voting is done at large across the state, that's just not really what's happening. I've covered a lot of city government, and when you have to get elected from a specific geographic district, that makes you accountable to your voters. You know, the last city government I covered was El Paso, Texas. And there, you know, the city council people, they have a breakfast in their district every single week, you know, at the same place, so that if your garbage isn't getting picked up or whatever, you can go talk right to them and people go. We don't do that here in Columbus, and it's because of the majority on city council. I don't know. I covered it when they first went to this system. And why not have people just represent actual districts instead of pretending like it?
I don't know. We're going to leave it at that. All right. So WOSU has a voter's guide that you can find at our website, WOSU.org. And you can find out a lot of information about all of the races that will be on your ballot tomorrow and reminding you to vote. Shane, before we take a break, you reported on, it's just election adjacent, so I wanted to cover it now. You reported on Secretary of State Frank LaRose testifying in support of a bill that would address voter fraud and non-citizen voting, as well as absentee ballot return deadlines. So I want to note, voter fraud is very rare, but aren't there already things in place to address this? Why do we need another bill?
It's still a concern among conservatives, and President Donald Trump's also made a huge issue over whether or not non-citizens are voting. We actually did adopt a constitutional amendment here in Ohio a few years ago that you can't vote if you are a non-citizen. Secretary of State Frank LaRose has actually made it a big part of his work lately, too, where he's constantly trying to weed out what he says are non-citizens. So this election bill is Senate Bill 153, and it's kind of a big overarching bill. It does a lot of different areas. It gives his office the ability to, it kind of codifies into law what his citizen verification process. It will allow them to kind of tap into a lot of different systems to make sure everything's matching correctly. It also, one of the big, more controversial things is it would ban drop boxes.
Unmanned
drop boxes. That was the big distinction that they were making in the testimony, though. So Franklin County does a thing where you can drive up and there will be a couple guys standing there and you hand them their ballot and they stick it in the box and they'll hand you a sticker.
That's a man drop box.
That will be still allowed. Okay. Where you just have this box that's like out in front of the Board of Elections that's there 24 hours a day. Mm. You can drop it at any time. There are laws on that, though, that it has to be monitored. Mm-hmm. So there is like surveillance of it for 24 hours. And they do ban ballot harvesting, where you collect a whole bunch of ballots and stick them all in there. But this would ban just those boxes outside the Board of Elections that no one's there at.
Okay. So if you wanted to drive up at 10 p.m. and stick your ballot in the box, you wouldn't be able to.
Unless the Board of Elections decides that it's worth it to have somebody standing out there at 10 p.m. Mm. And then there's also a bunch of people who are circulating petitions. There's a bunch of requirements that's kind of a little controversial in the bill too.
What does this bill do with absentee ballots, though? Does it changes the deadline?
Yeah. There's like two bills, so I'm kind of confused as to whether this one does it or if there's an adjacent bill. But that would require, right now, if your ballot shows up a couple days later to the Board of Elections, if you put it in the mail and it shows up a couple days later, but it's postmarked by a certain time, mm-hmm. they can still count it. This would make it so if it's not by the Board of Elections by election night, then it will not count.
Interesting.
Yes.
Well, I mean, that relies on the U.S. Postal Service to be efficient and fast.
And that was a big argument some of the opponents were making. But, Secretary Lewis and some of the supporters say 33 states do this already, though, that the ballot has to be there by election night.
To put a finer point on that, you're talking about a voter who has complied with the law and gotten their ballot in on time, and a mail slowdown effectively disenfranchises them.
Does this bill have legs? Does it have votes, or
It has legs. It's being pushed by some of the people in leadership in the Senate, and that elections are always a concern, and it seems like every cycle we have some sort of omnibus elections bill.
I had no idea there was so much in this bill.
Yeah.
All right,
and there was one more point I wanted to make. Okay. Senator Bill DeMoris from Columbus, he made a comment during the testimony where he was like, I just got something in the mail today that was sent 4 weeks ago. So he was making that point that mail could be kind of slow.
Yes, there is something that we have been waiting in the mail and it is completely lost. It was processed. We know we could track it, but like it never showed up. No idea where it is. Great. All right. Well, anyway. Coming up on the Reporter Roundtable, we're going to talk about efforts to end Medicaid funding related to Planned Parenthood. Plus, could Governor DeWine be forced to take pandemic-era unemployment compensation that he originally declined? That's when the Reporter Roundtable continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, we have Jake Zuckerman from a reporter with Signal Ohio, Ohio Capital Journal reporter Marty Schladen, and Shane Stegmiller, a reporter for Hannah News Service. The Ohio is seeking to end its Medicaid provider contract with Planned Parenthood facilities around the state. I wanted to talk about what this would mean for those seeking non-abortion-related care. Jake, did you write about this?
I did.
Okay. So tell me about what does it mean if Medicare doesn't have a contract with Planned Parenthood facilities, not abortion-related, just other things the Planned Parenthood does?
Right. So a little correction. We're talking about Medicaid, not
Medicare.
Medicaid.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
It says Medicaid, yes.
So Medicaid, by law, cannot fund abortions in Ohio, but Planned Parenthood offers a lot of reproductive adjacent services like STI stuff, cancer screenings for women, that sort of thing, and those are reimbursable costs in the Medicaid program. Mm-hmm. So the One Big Beautiful Bill, the Trump bill we've talked about a little today, was the big bill that passed over the summer, forbids for a term of 1 year any Medicaid funds from flowing to a, quote, prohibited entity, which is defined to basically only include Planned Parenthood. So for 1 year, no federal Medicaid money can go to a Planned Parenthood facility. And Ohio's Department of Medicaid has taken that from the Big Beautiful Bill and said, therefore, we are ending our provider contract with all Planned Parenthood facilities. But the kicker being the letter they issued, at least, doesn't specify any timeline. So you would assume it's an indefinite termination. Mm-hmm. So federal legislation is saying no Medicaid money to Planned Parenthood for 1 year. And the state, they're not explicitly saying we're doing this indefinitely, but that seems to be the only logical reading of this letter they sent out. Planned Parenthood has filed an administrative appeal of that, so there's going to be a hearing. How that shakes out is really anyone's guess, but it's pretty clear that a lot of Planned Parenthood facilities in Ohio have been closing under the pressure of the financial ban. So just
that's what I was wondering. Can Planned Parenthood stay open without Medicaid money?
I think that's the big question. And, you know, if they have been looking at this as well, it's just a year. We just got to get through the year and then maybe we can get our feet back under us. The state is sending a much more ominous signal.
Marty?
I just wanted to, you know, give a personal anecdote about the human cost of this, too. I used to know a woman who worked in restaurants, you know, so she didn't have regular health care. She didn't get regular pap smears. She got cervical cancer and died in her 40s. This is the kind of care we're talking about that Planned Parenthood provides. And, you know, having women lose that is not great. Mm-hmm.
Related to Medicaid, I keep wanting to say Medicare. I'm so sorry. Medicaid. Related to Medicaid, Governor DeWine has tapped, Scott Partika? Governor DeWine has tapped Scott Partika to be the next director of Medicaid. He's succeeding Maureen Corcoran, who is retiring. Shane, have you followed this at all, the change of hands at Medicaid?
It was something that he announced at the end of business on Friday.
Friday was a busy day, man. All right.
Last week was busy altogether. But yeah, he made that announcement. Corcoran had already announced her retirement. I believe he's currently a policy advisor within the DeWine administration.
Yeah, Partika is the assistant policy director focusing on health and human services. So we don't really know much more about him. What does this job entail if he is the Ohio's next director of Medicaid?
I mean, it's a pretty big job. I mean, you have to run a program that is billions of dollars.
Like $40 billion, maybe?
Something like that. So, I mean, it's a kind of a thankless job because you get pulled in front of the legislature often to have to explain what they're doing, and they have some tough questions for you. So,
all right. Well, we'll find out more about Scott Partika and also if that's how you say his name in the future, I'm sure. You're listening to All Sides Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking this hour with Shane Stegmiller from Hannah News Service, Jake Zuckerman from Signal Ohio, and Marty Schladen from the Ohio Capital Journal. Marty, there's nearly a quarter of Ohioans who live in rural areas, and there's a recent report, the Rural Policy Action Report, outlines some of the challenges and potential remedies. You reported on this. Can you tell me more about this Rural Policy Action Report?
It's an attempt to get a lot of interested groups together and basically just put these issues on the agenda. I don't know if you all are aware of Beth Macy. She's a reporter from Urbana. She just published
a book. Yeah, we're talking to her next week, Paper Girl, yes.
I talked to her last month. I've got a review that's about to run, but this is around the same issue. She went back to her hometown of Urbana. She's been gone for a long time. She lives in Roanoke, Virginia. She wrote like Dope Sick and some other stuff. And long story short, she got back to Urbana to check in on her hometown. She grew up on the poor side of the tracks, and she said things are way worse than when she got out in the 80s. And it has to do with global trade. It has to do with the opioid epidemic, the Great Recession. All these blows have been landed on these populations at the same time that local newspapers have disappeared. And so the way I saw this Rural Action Report is just a way, how do we come up with a set of policy prescriptions, you know, and it has to do with things that are technical sounding like antitrust support, which means basically, you know, what can we do to prop up mom and pop businesses, not drive them out of town, you know, better education funding. And then this report also wants to protect what is an important rural population, which is the immigrant community.
All right. Well, I feel like you and I should have a book club. We're both reading Beth Macy's book right now. So I guess you can read Marty's review soon in the Ohio Capital Journal. Is that where it's going to be?
Yep.
All right. And then you can hear my show on the 12th. That's when I'm talking to her. So, all right. Before we run out of time, Jake, Ohioans convicted of marijuana possession would have a chance to get their record wiped clean. Can you tell me about this?
Yeah, this was an idea that passed within a broader overhaul of, let's see, like marijuana, intoxicating hemp, and...
Oh, this was in the big,
yeah,
the big hemp
thing.
Yeah,
this was in the
okay.
big marijuana, one of All two right. big marijuana bills. But the gist of it, I mean, it's actually a pretty simple idea. If you have been convicted by the state of anything which is generally legal now under the current law, there's an expungement, a specific marijuana expungement process that's laid out under the bill. And the idea being it's very hard to get a job when you have to talk about your drug conviction with your employer. It's very hard mm-hmm. to get an apartment when you have to tell the landlord about your drug conviction. Expungement is a legal vehicle that literally just comes in with a big eraser and wipes that stuff from your record. That bill has passed the Senate, it's in conference committee. Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay, I don't know.
Yes, I'm sorry.
It's in conference committee.
My apologies to the listeners. Yes, it's in conference committee, which means the House and the Senate are going to need to negotiate it. That idea was not in both bills. Conference committees sometimes end with most ideas being, you know, appreciated and rolled into a big bill, and sometimes the whole thing gets rewritten and everything in there dies. So it's hard to say how that one ends, but it's a very potent mind. I mean, there's a lot of people, like tens of thousands of people who have been, I believe the story has some stats, but arrested, but not necessarily convicted. Very hard to find those conviction numbers, but mm-hmm. we're talking about a huge number of people who could be impacted by this.
Okay, so right now this big marijuana bill that relates to hemp and everything that is happening, it hasn't passed yet though, right?
That's correct. It has not passed. The House and Senate have both passed dueling interpretations of the bill, but those bills were passed at very different times and very different. The politics have shifted dramatically, basically, between both those chambers passing both those bills. So it's really hard to triangulate where that one ends.
Shane, is this another one that you think will get through and get done before the Thanksgiving break?
Yes, it's on one of their top agendas. And as Jake said, I just think it's one of those things where from when the Senate passed it to when the House passed it, so much has changed, and the House put a lot of stuff about hemp into the bill. So it's like, well, we just need to sit down and discuss it and figure it out and see mm-hmm. if this is where we want to end up. And so they are sending it to a conference committee. I think they've already started naming their conferees, so expect quick action on it.
Okay. But then this is something that kind of Governor DeWine pushed them to move a little quicker on, though, because he made the big hemp announcement saying that everyone needed to stop selling this stuff.
Well, and he issued the executive order, but that, of course, got held up in the courts.
Right.
I think some lawmakers have said that actually was a pretty successful pusher of just like, all right, let's just stop talking about this like we have been for the last 2 years and just do something. Let's find the consensus.
You have 132 members of the General Assembly, and a lot of people come down on different areas. I mean, some want everything legal, some people want nothing legal, and you've got to try and convince a majority of both chambers to go along with one idea.
There was also a lot of talk months ago related to the taxes of all of this. Is that in any of these bills?
The taxes stay as they were, but okay. the marijuana tax is newly applied to intoxicating hemp and, quote, drinkable cannabinoid products, which
Ooh,
is
that's
just
a
this
word.
Beautiful art of bureaucracy created by the lawmakers.
All right. We only have 2 minutes left, but one last topic. The Ohio Election Commission has issued new guidance that would allow political candidates to spend some campaign funds on security. So before, I guess, were they not allowed to spend it on security, but now they can? Is that...
Yeah, that goes back to the Mark Dan days where then Democratic Attorney General Mark Dan had spent some campaign funds on attorney. The Elections Commission said you can't do that. But my colleague and I just wrote a story about this. Basically, we talked to a lot of candidates and people in office now. And after the assassinations of Charlie Kirk and the lawmaker in Minnesota, the Democratic Speaker of the House of Minnesota, her name escapes me. But there is just a very clear culture of fear in the air. the Democrats keep a secure a state highway patrol member outside of their caucus when they have private meetings. They some of these political leaders who a lot of people haven't even heard of have felt scared enough that they have police details outside their homes after those killings. Mm. So all that to say, politicians are freaked out, and I think the Ohio Elections Commission recognized that the political environment has changed. I would say changed for the worse, to the point where they say it is now a justifiable expense to use donor dollars to fund personal security or home security, you know, ADT kind of systems for your house.
And I covered that meeting, and there was a lot of debate of how far should we go with it. You know, can somebody just spend just on an overall general fear, or do they have to have a specific threat? And so they really did try to work on the language to kind of make it succinct of when you can and can't.
Okay. So do you know, is it a specific threat? Or
I don't have the opinion in front of me, so I don't know where they...
I think it's not. I think that they gave a lot of latitude.
If you feel the sense of...
The draft was pretty lenient, so...
Well, I want to thank you for your time. We've been talking with Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hannah News Service. Thanks, Shane.
Thank you.
Jake Zuckerman, reporter for Signal Ohio. Thanks, Jake.
Thank you.
And Ohio Capital Journal reporter Marty Schladen. Thanks, Marty.
Thanks, Amy.
This has been the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.